This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The News and Observer may have uncovered a new figure in the University of North Carolina's academic scandal. Investigative reporter Dan Kane has been digging into the story for more than 5 years, and his latest article points to questions about whether an academic aide with UNC basketball may have played a role. We requested an interview with a representative from UNC Chapel Hill. They declined our request. Instead, they directed us to a letter written by their associate vice chancellor for communications. That letter published in the NNO, and of course, we will read parts of it today. But Dan Kane does join us. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
All right, so tell us about this article. Eric Hoots is the center of the article. What attracted you to him? What piqued your interest?
Well, someone had tipped me off to his media bios in the media guides, UNC's media guides, and particularly that he was no longer advertising his AFAM degree.
African-American Studies.
That is the department where, you know, this scandal erupted from, these fake classes going on for 18 years. So, and it was interesting that it was also at the same time when he gets, I guess, promoted, so to speak, where he gets additional responsibilities to become the academic coordinator for the team. And, you know, that's a position where you're basically tracking the progress of the players on the team. You want to make sure that they're, you know, they're going to class, they're keeping up on their studies, because, you know, if they're not, they may not be able to play on the court. They may be academically ineligible, can't play. That's a big problem,
right?
Okay?
Right.
So it's an important role. And so when I saw that, I decided, you know, we have these hundreds of thousands of records that were given to Ken Weinstein as part of his pretty extensive investigation. I'll search those and see what turns up. So I did, and two interesting emails surfaced, okay? One of them is from 2007, and this is when Eric was the video coordinator, okay? So he had no, you know, no role with academics whatsoever,
right,
in that job. But here is an email that he is sending to Debbie Crowder. It's slugged AFAM papers. It appears to have an attachment that appears to be AFAM papers. And, you know, he's sending them off to Debbie.
I'm going to stop you there and remind us who Debbie Crowder is.
Debbie Crowder was the architect of the paper class scheme.
Right.
And basically...
Yeah, tell us more.
Okay, so basically he's thanking her in this email, and I think he says he'll, you know, see her later or something like that. Pretty short email. But then there's another email that appears to be from a student, and the date has been redacted from it. Name of the sender has been redacted from it, but it also is labeled AFAM papers. It looks like there are two papers attached to it. One's identified as summer paper one. The other one's identified as summer paper two. And this person is in the email. It's a short email, but he's thanking Eric apparently for helping him, you know, with this. And says, you know, he says something literally the effect of, you know, I'll have to buy you lunch from here on out, something like that, you know. And so, you know, we went to the university and we went to Eric and asked, you know, really just asked to explain, you know, please explain, you know, what is behind these things and do they relate in any way to the scandal? And both of them turned us down, or I should say Eric didn't respond. The university turned us down. The university cited FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, for not producing such things as, you know, any records that would tell us whether or not, you know, the papers for those related to those emails were for these fake classes, you know. And, you know, as far as, you know, Eric goes, given the position he is in, you know, it would make sense that, just come out and just say, you know, look, here are the classes I took for my AFAM major, and show that, you know, he wasn't in any of these things.
No.
And
he was working for the university at the time, but again, having nothing to do with students, so you're curious about why he would be thanking someone who ends up at the center of these fake papers scandal, mm-hmm, why he and this student are saying thank you. Mm-hmm. It's curious. You ask them, and they won't answer you.
Yes.
All right, let me talk about the university now. And so that's the centerpiece of this story. Now, the university is saying that's a completely unfair article, that you have all of these tantalizing questions, but in your piece, you really have no answers. Rick White, UNC Chapel Hill's Associate Vice Chancellor for Communication, writes, and you published this letter alongside, mm-hmm, your piece, so it was in the paper with your piece. In the practice of journalism, any story with the words may or might in the headline isn't really a story. Dan Kane's story about Eric Hoots fits that rule to a T. You don't have proof in there. Why did you publish this thing? Why'd you write it?
Well, there is. You look at these, you know, between the AFAM degree, between the emails, between the fact that he now, you know, is not advertising his AFAM degree. You know, I mean, those are red flags. You know, they do. I think most people who see that say, you know, given the depth and the problem, I mean, the problems that this scandal created for the university, there ought to be some explanation here. They ought to be able to clear this up. And the fact that they won't, that pushed us. You know, we really need to tell the public about this.
Right. And in journalism, you're in this bind where, for instance, we asked the university, we've repeatedly asked the university to be on this program, and they repeatedly turn us down. What you can't do is say, well, if the other side won't show up, we're not going to talk about the story. Otherwise, that would be a very effective way to squelch every story. And so what you do is offer them the opportunity. And then when they don't, as they have so often refused on this show and other places, you have to go ahead without them.
Well, you know, this happened 4 years ago. 4 years ago, I found a test transcript on UNC's website. It looked very much like it belonged to an athlete, and it looked like that athlete had taken a lot of these bogus classes, brought it to their attention, spent a month asking them, please check your records, see whether this is a real transcript or not. They insisted it wasn't, but they wouldn't check the records. And so we did the story, and that transcript turned out to belong to Julius Peppers. It was a very important development in exposing this scandal.
Well, there's questions of how long it takes to turn over documents, transparency among universities, whether or not they will turn over the relevant documents is becoming an ever more important question as various scandals in various universities grab the headlines. Joining me now is Jonathan Jones, director of the Sunshine Center of the North Carolina Open Government Coalition. Jonathan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's glad to be here.
And we've been talking about Dan Kane's efforts to get more information about these emails. These go back years, you know, and it's taken a long time just to get them. We're talking about Eric Hoots now in this particular case. Your organization advocates for access to government records. What's your take on the story? Again, using FERPA to deny any kind of comment about this story.
Well, one of the things that has been consistent throughout this scandal with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill has been its reluctance to timely turn over information that's clearly a public record. And it's been my position and those of others in the transparency movement that the university should have been upfront from the very beginning and should get as much of this information out to the public as possible, as quickly as possible. And that simply hasn't happened. There have been some efforts here and there, and this seems to be another example of the university sort of dragging its feet on answering questions. One of the things that's been consistent is the university's use of FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, to deny access to records that clearly aren't covered by FERPA. Now, in this instance, there are some things that Dan has asked for that may be covered by FERPA, and there are some things that probably are not. But what we know is the university has a long track record of using FERPA to withhold information that it shouldn't.
Talking to Jonathan Jones and also Dan Kane today on the state of things. Tell us more about FERPA and who it's designed to protect. It's students and their names that shouldn't go out. But tell us more about sort of
sure. So FERPA is a 40-year-old law that was designed to create two rights on behalf of students. The first right is to access their own records. The second right is a privacy right in their personally identifiable education records, as well as their disciplinary records. And so those are the things that it's intended to do. One of the things that we've seen happen is universities across the country, not just in North Carolina, take a very expansive view of what an educational record is in justifying withholding information.
Now, also, you're seeing an increase in student newspapers and really any media associated with the university being intimidated and punished. Are we seeing an increase in that?
Well, we're certainly seeing a greater deal of antagonism between the student press and their universities than we've seen probably since the 1960s or 70s, when a number of these student publications moved to become independent of their universities. One of the things we've seen quite a lot in the last few years is our lawsuits filed by student publications against their universities for failing to give information that is, in some cases, clearly public record, and in other cases, perhaps questionably public record. And there's a couple of those that are fairly high profile going on right now, including one involving the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, having been sued by the Daily Tar Heel. You also have a lawsuit going on in Kentucky where the Kentucky Colonel and the University of Kentucky are embattled in the courts.
Well, in that case, it's the university suing the paper, right, in Kentucky.
Yes, although that's partially a quirk of Kentucky law that as to why the university is the one bringing the suit. But what had happened there was there was an investigation into a professor who had sexually harassed several students, including allegations that he had grabbed them in inappropriate ways. And the professor was removed from the faculty and still paid his $100,000 salary for a significant period of time. And the student paper had asked for a copy of the investigation, which they denied, citing FERPA, even though it was clearly not a FERPA-covered record. And
obviously you can redact the names of the students in this case.
Sure.
Well, that was in Kentucky. We're talking also about the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll talk more about that, but I want to thank you for now because we're out of time. Jonathan Jones, director of the Sunshine Center of North Carolina's Open Government Coalition. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Frank.
And also Dan Kane, investigative reporter with the News and Observer. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
As I say, we requested an interview with the representative from UNC Chapel Hill. They denied our request. Just ahead, we'll hear about a new exhibit that celebrates the legacy of renowned horticulturalist J.C. Ralston on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.